This is WJBC This Week.
My heart hurts for Matt and his family.
We were all shocked. I was certainly shocked to hear the news.
Does America have a problem with gun violence? Yes. Does Illinois? Does Chicago? Of course. And the obvious question is, what are we going to do about it?
This is not about guns. This is about control.
We do not anticipate sending any refunds, tax refunds, until March 1st, 2016.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we have a reaction to President Obama's executive orders on guns from the McLean County Sheriff and a weapons instructor. U.S. Cellular Coliseum unveils new security measures. An advocate for education reform pushes school choice. Plus, the state plans to delay tax refund checks this year. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Federal authorities announced this week they had filed wire fraud charges against McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen for allegedly participating in a consulting scheme during his time at State Farm, where he pocketed over $400,000 for work he never did. The 49-year-old Republican from Bloomington is due in court next week. We got reaction this week from many of his colleagues on the county board, including Rich Buchanan.
My reaction right now is one of being personally interested and concerned about one of the best chairmen we've had. And my first reaction is a personal concern and sadness whenever a friend, and especially someone occupying a position, I didn't know what I was getting into when I went on the county board. It's a big difference from mayor or councilman in the city of Bloomington, but I'm just enjoying the dickens out of it. And part of the reason is the quality of administration of the office of chairman. And let me throw a vice chairman in there, too, with McIntyre. My first concern is a personal one for Matt. When you got a friend that's got real problems, but you don't know the detail of the problems, and I'm sure not going to convict him, in an interview, so I'm not even giving any thought to that. And I felt that responses from some of my colleagues, from all who responded, I had a little problem with it. I am very interested. I will follow this very closely, including talking to the extent that it would be appropriate with the process, including talking with Matt personally. Now, he may not be in a position to do that, but I'll be surprised if he doesn't, because I just want to make sure he's okay. But we don't know much about it, so I think I've just given you my comment about it. And that means that I shall, once official activities start taking place, of course, most of them will be outside the purview of a county board member, because it's in that morass that we call a legal justice system, and it isn't perfect, and sometimes it's totally imperfect, but it's I think the best one in the world from what I can tell. So, but I'm going to stay in touch with it, I'm still in the mode of I'm really upset about it, and it's related not to my question, why did he do it? I don't know that he did it. My heart hurts for Matt and his family, but you know what? I think he's strong enough to represent himself well in what he's going to be facing.
That was McLean County Board Member Rich Buchanan with Joe Ragusa. President Obama issued executive orders this week aimed at curbing gun violence. The White House is seeking to expand background checks for buyers. He also plans to provide more funding for the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives agents to enforce gun laws, while also boosting funding for mental health treatment. Polls show a majority of Americans overwhelmingly support the president's efforts. The gun lobby, though, dug in its heels to prepare for another battle over the Second Amendment. Mike Bias, chief instructor for Illinois Gun Pros, talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
It's really just politics. It's not addressing the problem, and it's really a shame. Let me give you an example. Dick Morris was a pollster for Bill Clinton. And back when Bill Clinton was in the White House, he said, you know what, we have got enough power and momentum in Congress. We don't need to just increase minimum wage. We could index it to inflation, and we have enough votes to do it so that every year the minimum wage would go up. And Clinton said, nope. He didn't want that because he didn't care about the people. He wanted that as an issue for every campaign, every 4 years, to say, hey, Democrats will give you more of a minimum wage. So this is all, you know, documented in one of Dick Morris's many books. But this is the same thing that's what's going on with Mr. Obama. This is not about guns. This is about control. Under the Obama administration, federal prosecution of gun crimes is down to the levels that we haven't seen since the year 2000. And that's before all the Mexican drug gangs and drug wars and stuff is spilled across the border. He is not wanting to put people in jail with federal offenses. That's for whatever reason. I don't know if his U.S. attorneys are busy prosecuting people who are using gender-specific terms or what. But the fact is, the proof is in the pudding. Federal gun of crime prosecutions are way down under Mr. Obama.
But Mike, we've had more shootings in 2015 than we had days in the year, and more people shot. Do you understand the president's, I guess, frustration with Congress not doing anything?
No, I don't understand that frustration, because if you want to do something, get the people off the streets who are committing these crimes. And we have the tools available to us now. There was a very good instance. There was a man in Bloomington who he broke into someone's house, put a gun to their head, threatened to kill him. Here's a home invasion, and an attempted murder. And the guy was off he was out of jail within 2 years. Had the same crime been committed in Florida, the man would have been away for 25 years. And now that's just state laws. If the U.S. attorney in Chicago, Chirac, as they call it, the U.S. attorney in Chicago, in northeastern Illinois, is the second worst in the country for bringing federal charges. A lot of these people are felons. If you're a felon and you possess a handgun, that means if you're a felon, Terry, and you come out to the shooting range with me, I hand you my gun and you take a few shots for practice, you just committed a federal violation because you're possessing a firearm. If you're a felon, you cannot even touch or hold a gun. So the laws are there, but the U.S. attorney in northeastern Illinois is the second worst in the entire country for bringing gun federal charges. So why don't they do this? They have a federal crime. You're looking at 5 years to 10 years minimum for most of these crimes. But they have the tool, but they choose not to use it.
What about the criminals that go to gun shows specifically to buy guns because they won't get a background check?
That's a red herring. That's a bunch of garbage because, for instance, in Illinois, you can't do that. In Illinois, you still have to have a background check, and you have to run a FOID check. You have to have a FOID card in Illinois. So that's not going to do anything in Illinois, number one. And number two, there was a very poignant moment when Mr. Obama's press secretary was asked point blank, can you tell us which of these mass shootings would have been prevented had we had better background checks? And he could not answer. And the reason is, you cannot show any evidence that any of these mass shootings would have been prevented by these background checks. These background checks are
feel-good legislation. Well, we should do something. Well, let's pass out cotton candy. You know, that would be just as effective as, you know, increasing background checks. So let me put the onus back on you instead of me just spouting facts and statistics. And this is a rhetorical question, Terry, for you and for all the listeners. Find me how many of these mass shootings at San Bernardino and Sandy Hook, how many would have been prevented with background checks, enhanced background checks? And the answer is none of them. So this boogeyman of criminals are getting guns through these loopholes, no, that's not how they're getting the guns.
I do want to hear more from the president on this because I did a little background, and actually I'm a regular watcher of 60 Minutes. They did a story about these smart guns, and there is a law on the books in New Jersey. I'll share with you two things. There's a law on the books in New Jersey that says if one smart gun is sold in the country, that that's the only type of gun they'd be able to sell. That's a little-known law created in 2002, passed in 2002. There is also a situation where another gun dealer said that he was going to start selling smart guns. He was then threatened to be raped and killed if he sold smart guns. Then this was reported by 60 Minutes. What is with people that are so scared of these smart guns being sold? That's a part I don't understand.
Well, I'm not familiar with that particular case, but I can tell you this. The whole idea of a smart gun is ludicrous. It's ludicrous because if I have to wear a bracelet, for instance, to match it to the gun, what if the bracelet falls off during a struggle? If the gun only responds to my DNA or my fingerprint, and I'm a police officer and I'm in a gunfight, that means my fellow police officer can't pick up that gun and use it to protect us. You know, the smart gun is something maybe 50 years from now, but that technology, even implementing it, even if we had the technology, is just fraught with difficulties and craziness. So I'm a legal gun owner. If somebody breaks into my house, I'm not home, but my teenage son, legally in Illinois, could grab my gun and defend the family and kill the person, and he would not be charged, nor would I be charged. But with smart guns, he would pick up the gun, and nothing would happen.
That was Mike Bias of Illinois Gun Pros with Terry James. And McLean County Sheriff John Sanded says the real issue behind gun violence is often being overlooked, as he talked with Terry James this week.
They need to look at the root cause of some of this gun violence, and a lot of it leads back to mental health issues. That's where the money needs to be put, on expanding services, and I think he pledged $500 million to it. I don't know that that's going to be a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. I mean, someone made the comment to me yesterday, and I kind of agreed with it. It said, in the city of Chicago, the law right now is that you cannot have a gun in the city, on the street.
Right.
But that's where the violence is occurring. So it's criminals getting these guns into their hands right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And the citizens that are obeying the current law up there are the victims.
Absolutely. And I think this thing is going to be debated quite a bit. And I understand what you're saying, that you're still going through it, because when we received it here as a list of what he was going to talk about, it's pages and pages and pages,
right,
of specifically what he wanted done there. Continuing work in the jail, that project continues. And Mike suggested a question that I think is a very good one, which is how far along are we with the architectural process of getting that moving forward?
We've received proposals from architects. The next step is to interview those architects and to pick one. And then, of course, the drawings will come after that, and we'll figure out what works, what doesn't, and hopefully early 2017 we'll be breaking ground.
Sounds like we're already making improvements. You know, last year I did an end of the year piece here for the station on mental health, and we started at the beginning of the year not knowing where money was going to come from. We have the sales tax increase now.
Correct.
And have you started to receive any of that money, do you know, or does that take a little while?
I think it's going to take a while before it starts coming in, but it's just the way the whole community has addressed the issue is very impressive. They realize the lack of services and what was needed in the community, and everybody has come together, and we're dealing with it.
Talking with Sheriff John Sandage, McLean County, talked to our coroner, Kathy Davis. She came in, and she talked about the number of suicides that we've had in the year. And as it got closer to the holidays, we had additional suicides. This is a, you know, we went a whole year without murders, but suicides are a problem in this county. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And what can we do to remove that stigma and start talking about this more and improve the problem?
I think, you know, little things. If you think somebody is upset and they need to talk to somebody, offering to talk to them, offering to listen to them, ask them, you know, what's going on, and taking the stigma away from getting help if they need it.
Yeah, and we had somebody on yesterday who just told us that if somebody mentions it, not to ignore it, to let them talk about it, because that has to be pretty upsetting for, I know, your deputies when they go out and find out that someone died unnecessarily.
Oh, absolutely. It affects everybody, and it's never a pleasant call to go to, and you know, you always leave there wondering why. And of course, hindsight's 20/20 as far as what could have been done, steps taken to prevent that. But hopefully that the more emphasis we put on it and the more education we put out there, we'll lessen the number of suicides.
That was McLean County Sheriff John Sandage with Terry James. If you're expecting to get a tax refund from the state, don't expect it until March. Illinois is delaying the state's income tax refund checks. The Illinois Department of Revenue says it's for our own safety. Spokesman Terry Horstman talked with WJBC's Joe Ragusa this week.
Is that a tentative date, or is that a really set-in-stone goal for the Department of Revenue to get the state refunds out?
Well, we are taking additional steps to protect Illinois taxpayers from identity theft and fraud. So at this point in time, we do not anticipate sending any refunds, tax refunds, until March 1st, 2016. This is to ensure that the security and confidentiality of taxpayer information we have, to ensure the security and confidentiality of taxpayer information, we have initiated a review process to combat against fraudulently filed returns. As a result of the new security measures, refunds may take longer to process this year than in previous years.
And are these kind of an extension of what the Department of Revenue started doing last year? I know that last year that there was also a delay in the refund or the return of state income tax refunds.
And that's correct. The decision comes as fraud prevention efforts from last year's tax season illustrate the positive impact that additional delays and scrutiny have had in combating tax return fraud and identity theft. And this is very similar to what many other states around the country have been implementing as well.
So what exactly are the changes that were, I guess, worked on last year and are being implemented again this year?
Sure. Well, there are certain security protocols that we have used to detect and stop fraudulently filed returns, many of which we don't discuss openly. But the other component to it is delaying refund returns so that we can better match up information from taxpayers with the information that we're receiving to ensure that the individuals that that file the tax return are who they say they are.
And I saw, at least in some of the reports about this situation last year when the initial announcement was made, that there was 408 tax-based fraud complaints in Illinois in 2014. Do you have any sort of an update on the number of fraud-based complaints from 2015?
I do not have specific numbers. I believe those are still being compiled at this point.
Okay. Do you know how much fraudulent activity or even processing fraud complaints costs the state of Illinois on a yearly basis?
Well, I can tell you that last year's tax season resulted in overall savings of nearly $5 million that would have been otherwise paid out to fraudulent tax filers. So our new security protocols are certainly benefiting in detecting and stopping fraudulently filed returns.
And I know that, you know, obviously making sure people don't get money they're not owed is a pretty big deal. But as far as the actual cost of fraud prevention. I mean, is it something that's being being outweighed by that?
We certainly have. It's more of a fine-tuning our internal mechanisms and initiating delays. So there are certainly some costs involved, but the gain, the benefit, certainly outweighs any cost.
Okay, and the only reason I'm asking that is specifically because I saw in some of my pre-reading before this interview that some states it costs as much as $30 million to do fraud prevention kind of activity, and I don't know if Illinois is in that same realm as far as the potential cost of fraud prevention being that high. And, you know, if the state's only saving about $5 million in money that would have gone to fraudulent recipients, that's a pretty big disparity as far as that's concerned. But you're saying it's not necessarily the case with Illinois?
No, we certainly certainly fraud prevention tactics certainly outweigh any cost that it would cost the taxpayers. That's for sure.
And as far as I mean, anytime anything like this comes up, you know, we have to talk about the fact that the state of Illinois doesn't have a budget. But this actually isn't really a function of that, is it?
That's correct. Tax refunds are not subject to budgetary appropriation by the Illinois General Assembly, so they're therefore not impacted by the current budget impasse.
And as far as actual money that goes towards fraud prevention services, like what you're trying to enact this year, is that also money that's funded? I guess self-sufficient funding. Does that also come from tax revenue, and that has nothing to do with state appropriations?
That's correct. It comes out of the annual budget within the Department of Revenue.
Gotcha. So it's all under the same umbrella. It's, you know,
correct.
None of it is really a problem. None of it is really tied with the state budget impasse. All right.
Correct.
That was Terry Horstman of the Illinois Department of Revenue with Joe Ragusa. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The theme behind National School Choice Week is that every child in the U.S. should be able to attend a school that meets his or her needs. It'll be recognized the final week of January. School Choice President Andrew Campanella talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Why isn't it a bad idea to do what we do now, which is you live in a certain place, you can't afford a private school, so you're assigned to a public school in your area?
It's a bad idea to assign people to schools without regard to their talents, their skills, their abilities, the challenges they face, because that's just not how we do anything else in America today. For example, college. If you don't have money to attend a great college, you can get a scholarship or you can get a Pell Grant. Your parents can choose or you can choose any type of college you want to attend, whether it's a public university or community college, a technical school, a private or religious university, etc. If we have a system like that in K-12 education, we can have the same results as we do in higher education, which is the best education system in the world. Right now, the United States, out of 27 developed countries, has the 22nd lowest graduation rate.
Well, you know, the only problem I see here is that there's going to be some schools that may have bad reputations, maybe deserved, maybe not deserved, that are going to go empty if we go to this.
You know, you will have situations where schools are not appealing to parents. They're not serving kids. Kids are not learning. Nobody wants to go there. So I guess the question needs to be asked, do we want to force people to keep going to schools like that? Do we want to keep pumping more money into schools that are not working for kids? Or do we want to use those funds, expand schools that are working, transform schools that don't work into schools that do, and those that attract kids as well? So what I wanted to focus on is not the bricks and mortar, the actual schools themselves, but the students who go to them, the teachers who teach in them, and what can we do to make sure that every kid has access to at least a school that can inspire them to learn and get prepared for real life.
Do you think that if we enact this, this could force some schools to make better decisions and improve?
Absolutely. Competition works, and that's what we see in places across the country that have robust public and private school choice. For example, we spend more money on education right now than we ever have in our nation's history, but Unfortunately, a lot of that money is not going where it needs to go, and that is to great teachers. Instead, it's going to middle managers and bureaucrats, and we have seen since 1950 a 600% increase in the number of administrators in our schools. If we have school choice and parents put competitive pressure on schools, schools will be forced to improve or provide services that parents want, and that starts with getting the best teachers and rewarding them so they stay.
So what about the tax system? Would this cause parents to have to pay more? Would we still have the same property tax system when it comes to paying for our schools? What about the whole payment situation?
The way that that it works in a lot of different places is sort of like backpack funding. You have a certain percentage of income or funding that is allocated by the state, and the student can take that money in a backpack, essentially, to the school they want to attend, and the school gets that funding. Now, that could be another public school. It could be a charter school. It could be a magnet school. It could be an online school. It could be a private school. It depends on the programs available in the state. Other states are exploring things called education savings accounts, where parents can actually get the state allocation of dollars for their student's education and decide exactly how to spend that money. When we do that, we actually drive down costs for education while prioritizing where the money goes. So it may have an impact on the tax system, but certainly costs will go down.
What about transportation?
That's always a challenge. Transportation is a challenge, and it's something that needs to be worked on. But in places like, for example, Illinois has a lot of great charter schools and a lot of great traditional public schools. And the transportation issues are worked out within districts and also outside of districts. There are private transportation options. Certainly, that is an issue with more school choice we can have addressed.
You mentioned something earlier that intrigued me, and that was online schools. Are you suggesting that in a K through 12 system, we could send children to school on their laptop?
Actually, yes. And in fact, more than 30 states have full-time, statewide, free public online academies. And these are schools where students can log in the morning, interact with a real, highly qualified, you know, certified teacher who educates them, and it doesn't matter where the teacher is, could be here, could be in a different state, et cetera, and they take tests online and are monitored very, very closely. Some of these schools are incredibly innovative, and if you think about this generation of students who are going through school now, these kids grew up with video games, computers, the internet, cell phones, tablets. Online learning is actually a natural extension of what they grew up with, and some kids find they actually learn more that way. Of course, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, when you say it's not for everybody, I mean, the one thing I think about is school is not just about learning. Maybe it should be, but there's a social aspect to going to school. And, I mean, it's just a thing where you sit at lunch, who you become friends with, how you make friends. There's that component there as well.
You know, that's exactly right, and I agree with that. And I think that as we expand technology into education and do it in a smart way, and by that I mean not just spending a ton of money and giving every kid an iPad or a laptop, but saying, okay, how can we actually use technology to improve student learning? We need to make sure that we don't get rid of the important social aspects of education as well, because there is a level of social development that goes on in school that's important. A lot of times these online learning programs are for high school level classes, and students have already been exposed to a traditional bricks and mortar school once they go into the online academy. These programs work a lot for students who may have otherwise dropped out of school, students who've been bullied, or student athletes who might be very, very smart and very talented, but have schedules that are different than can accommodate a traditional school day.
Yeah, athletics is another part where people think you need a school environment to do athletics. Would you think that there would need to be more programs, maybe with YMCA getting involved, YWCA, the Boys and Girls Clubs, those types of things that would need to be in play with these ideas?
You know, what we need to do is we need to look at, you know, the number one goal of school, and that's to educate kids and get them prepared for college, get them prepared for the workforce, perhaps, get them ready for real life. And sports is important. And we need to look at things like community sports leagues and, maybe rethink the way we do you know, school-based events and extracurricular activities. You know, homeschooling families in many states want to be able to send their kids and have them play sports for a local team because those parents are paying taxes into the school system, and they're not getting any of the benefits of it. So they want to be able to send their kids to those, you know, you have their kids play sports in those places too. I think they should.
And should there be schools? You know, I keep Common Core keeps popping up in my head, and I'm thinking, should there be schools that follow this Common Core, but then an option for parents who don't want their children to learn based on Common Core?
You know, one of the things that, that has struck me over the last few years as we've talked about Common Core has been that had our country just done school choice and more robust school choice, we wouldn't need things like Common Core because we don't. We would be able to drive up results and increase achievement because there is competition. By creating a set of standards that may be good standards, I have not read them start to finish, but they may be good, they may be bad. But if they're mandated from the federal government or coerced from the federal government and then implemented in many cases very, very poorly at great cost at the state and local level, you're not going to get a great result. How you will get a great result and what is proven to get a great result is school choice. When you give parents more options, kids graduate at much higher levels and they graduate better prepared for real life. And I think that's what we need. We don't need more experiments. We need to use what works, and that's parent power.
That was Andrew Campanella of National School Choice Week with Terry James. If you're going to a concert or a game at U.S. Cellular Coliseum, you'll be subject to new security measures. The Coliseum's booking and marketing director, Tracy Andracki, outlined the changes when she talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
We're going to start changing things, whether it be for a hockey game all the way up to a big headliner concert. The bags no larger than 13 by 15 by 6 would be admitted into the Coliseum.
Right.
And I immediately looked at my purse and went, I think I'm on the edge of that bag limit.
There's probably a lot of women that are right on that edge as well. So, I mean, you could take a ruler out and measure it if you wanted to, but we're saying, you know, a small to medium-sized purse. I mean, it's best if you really just want to bring, like, a crossbody, like, or a wristlet.
If I want to dance, yeah. I need something that I don't have to hold on to.
Yeah, but just something really small. All you really need is, you know, just the essentials. So there's no reason to bring your whole big purse.
And this is my, like, day tote. You know, the one that has the bag inside the bag.
Sure.
And you're a mom of two little kids. You know what that's like.
My bags are huge.
Yeah. Lots and lots of
bags. So this affects me, too.
Interesting point, though, that came out as you were talking about how certain items are not going to be accepted in. Of course, outside food and beverage. Hey, people with the flasks, stop trying. They're finding you.
Right.
Stop it. Professional cameras was something new on the list. Now, how do you designate between people taking pictures with a smartphone or a tablet
sure.
versus a professional camera?
Well, it's a little bit of a gray area because photography is become so good on, you know, smaller devices
right.
like, you know, iPhones and that kind of thing.
Sure.
As well as you have the ability to take video. But professional.
All those things that the artists don't want you to do.
Exactly.
And yet they also do because it's positive on social media.
Yeah. But yeah, for most concerts, they're not wanting any professional photography. So it's detachable lenses, that kind of photography.
Okay, the SLR type cameras.
Exactly. So, you know, if you are of a media source and want to be taking pictures, you should be contacting us in advance for a media pass.
And that's a great thing to do. I did that for the benefit concert for the tornado victims. And that gave me the opportunity to get up close for at least the first couple of songs.
Yep.
And then I had to back myself back up, you know, which was not a problem, just so I could take pictures and document it. But it was very easy to do that if you're a legitimate media source.
Yeah. Yeah. The shows will take all of the requests into consideration and then give you their restrictions, and so it works.
How many people do you have to stop and say, that chain belt, not going to work?
It depends on what kind of event. At a rock show, we see a lot more
stylistically.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, at a children's show, we'll see more diaper bags. At a country show, we might see, you know, bigger bags. Or, mm-hmm. you know, at a rock show, we might see some chain belts, that kind of thing. So it's all depending upon the demographic that's coming. So in the past, like for a hockey game, or, you know, other of our sports tenants, we haven't been as diligent about checking bags. It's always been the policy to not bring anything in. But now for every event, we will be checking bags and not allowing bags over that size limit.
True or false, Tracy? And this is, again, Tracy Andracki from USAO Coliseum, extraordinary booker. And your official title is assistant GM, correct?
That is correct, yeah.
You have had these requests for improved security procedures come, in some cases, from the traveling artists coming to the venue.
That is absolutely correct. So, you know, a lot of the worldwide and nationwide promoters are putting their shows into venues of all different sizes, of all different, you know, some have professional NHL, NBA type teams in there that have certain restrictions already. Some do not. Mm-hmm. And so they're wanting us to kind of keep everything the same so that they can ensure that they're not only their artists, but also their fans are coming to a safe environment. World events recently have contributed to a lot of that, mm-hmm. You know, taking a harder look at how to make this atmosphere more safe for the patrons that are coming to the events. So,
movie theaters still don't do security, and yeah. We've had events, obviously, at movie theaters that have made people question what's going on.
Well, sure.
Out of curiosity, and I don't want to give away any secret security that you do, but do venues usually have an eye in the sky instead of just the beefy security people walking around looking tough, trying to see
yeah.
what they see? From up above, sometimes I'm in the Radio Bloomington suite, I can see a lot more from that vantage point as to what's going down on the floor.
We do. We have actually personnel, but we also have cameras. Cameras have been installed recently. And then with our video system upgrade, we also have an additional really amazing camera that's in the Arena Bowl that can zoom in. So we can see your faces. We can see a lot of things that you wouldn't imagine that we can see.
Yeah, that's fun when you're doing like a kiss cam moment. To have that ability.
Sure.
But it's also nice to have the documentation of video problems if you should have any legal issues.
Absolutely. So we pretty much can see all areas of the building at all times.
That was USAO The Coliseum's Tracy Andracki with Susan Saunders. The weekend news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the weekend news. The dust is still settling after McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen was indicted on federal wire charges this week. WJBC's Joe Ragusa got reaction from members of the county board.
Democrat Carlo Robustelli says it's too early to comment about Sorensen's future on the board.
I'm taking a wait-and-see approach to the accusations facing Mr. Sorensen. I don't have sufficient information to make a determination as to what, if anything, the county board will do in reaction.
Republican Rich Buchanan says the situation is unlike anything he's ever seen since he entered local politics in 1968.
I don't think anything of substance like this has ever happened, and I'm sorry it's happened, and bad things happen to good people.
Sorensen is accused of pocketing over $400,000 in fees for consultant work that was never actually completed. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
County Administrator Bill Wasson has said administrators are reviewing the matter with legal counsel. Mitsubishi Motors and a few local taxing bodies have resolved a dispute over how much the automaker's plant in Normal is worth. Mitsubishi was appealing the values of two properties it pays taxes on, including the now-closed manufacturing plant, in an effort to reduce its tax obligation. The two properties were originally worth an assessed value of $9.4 million. The two sides agreed it should be $7 million. That means about $200,000 less in tax revenue for Unit 5, the Town of Normal, Heartland Community College, and others. The deal won't be final until after a 30-day appeal period. A former Bloomington Alderman is being remembered for his public service. Jim Finnegan died last week at the age of 82. He had served 12 years on the Bloomington City Council, beginning in 1997. Current Alderwoman Karen Schmidt, a council member since 1999, says it was never hard to know where Finnegan stood on an issue.
He didn't have a lot of patience with politics or with people spending too much time on an issue or waffling.
The picture of Normal's new fire department headquarters is more clear. after the town approved design services with BLDD. The new station will be located in the 600 block of Main Street. City Manager Mark Peterson explains how the town will pay for what is expected to be a near $8 million project.
Last year, we issued a $10 million general obligation bond. Part of that was for the fire station. We'll be issuing another bond sometime the first quarter of this year that will make up the rest of the funding. We're putting a little bit of cash. We have a little bit of cash we'll put into it.
The plan is to begin construction in June. BLDD explained a timeline that puts completion of the firehouse in summer of 2017. In Illinois, December was the warmest and second wettest on record. State climatologist Jim Angel says the average figures were 41 degrees at about 6.5 inches. It's about 11 degrees and 4 inches, respectively, above the average. The only December with more precipitation was in 1982. 23 Illinois counties have been named state disaster areas because of flooding over the recent weeks. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen is scheduled to face a hearing in federal court in Chicago on charges related to a wire fraud scheme stemming from his time as a consultant for State Farm. Also Monday, Tracy Newsom is scheduled to stand trial on murder charges for the shooting death of Carlton Jordan on Bloomington's west side in November of 2014. And Monday night, Bloomington Alderman will discuss outsourcing management of the city's three golf courses. On Tuesday, an appellate court will hear arguments from attorneys for a Livingston County woman, Heather Lamy, who was trying to get her murder conviction reversed for the beating death of her three-year-old foster daughter. Also Tuesday, Illinois State University and Heartland Community College will host a social media watch party for the State of the Union address. And next Saturday night, country star Jason Aldean brings his We Were Here tour to U.S. Cellular Coliseum. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.